which, by the way, is a fight and a discussion worth having, but we can't have it at the ninth hour.
The federal government shutdown reaches day 3 with no clear signs of any progress in negotiations.
For Friday, October 3rd, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, OpenAI has launched a new social media app where all the videos are fake.
We may be entering an era when the stuff that we see just isn't believable at all. Like, seeing is no longer believing.
And it's easy to show empathy and support the families of people killed in mass shootings.
What about the families of the alleged shooters?
We are going to forgive him, and the concrete thing we're going to do to show our forgiveness is we're going to love his family.
Plus, our critics' take on the new Taylor Swift album.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Hamas says it's accepted some elements of President Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza, including giving up power and releasing all remaining hostages, but that others require further discussion. The statement came hours after Trump said Hamas must agree to the deal by Sunday evening or face an even greater military onslaught. Hopes for a quick end to the government shutdown faded today as both sides dug in their heels. Meanwhile, President Trump is threatening mass layoffs and further cuts across the federal government. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Rather than working with us to end the pain Americans are feeling because of a shutdown, Republicans have instead, they've wasted a week, refused to talk, and exacerbated pain for America.
Democrats want an extension to health care subsidies. Republicans want to reopen the government mostly at current spending levels. Speaker Mike Johnson is canceling House votes next week as Republicans pressure Senate Democrats to accept the short-term funding bill and end the shutdown. The Trump administration is withholding more than $2 billion for infrastructure projects in Chicago. NPR's Joel Rose reports it's part of a broader funding fight targeting Democratic areas during the shutdown.
White House Budget Director Russ Vogt says the Department of Transportation has put on hold more than $2 billion to improve Chicago's transit system. Vogt said the pause is intended to, quote, ensure funding is not flowing via race-based contracting, unquote. Earlier, the Trump administration said it would withhold $18 billion in federal funds from major rail and subway projects in New York on similar grounds. That appears to be targeting New York congressional leaders, including Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, whom the White House is trying to blame for the government shutdown. Schumer called the tactics, quote, stupid and counterproductive. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
The U.S. says it's destroyed another boat in the Caribbean just off the coast of Venezuela. NPR's Ader Peralta reports it's the fourth boat targeted by the U.S.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said the attack killed four men whom he accused of being, quote, narco-terrorists. President Trump alleged the boat was loaded with enough drugs to kill up to 50,000 people, but the White House has offered no evidence of that. Venezuela says these are provocations by the U.S., which is intent on toppling the leftist authoritarian government of President Nicolas Maduro. Venezuela's Minister of Defense, Vladimir Padrino, said they had also detected five American F-35s flying very close to Venezuelan territory on Thursday.
Es una amenaza contra la seguridad de la nación.
This is a threat against the security of the nation, he said. Ader Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
Sean Diddy Combs has been sentenced to over 4 years in prison in a case involving sex workers and violence. The judge said he was unconvinced Combs wouldn't commit the crimes again if he were released. Combs was convicted of flying people across state lines for drug-fueled marathon sexual encounters. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Des Moines Public Schools alleges a consulting company did not properly vet Superintendent Ian Roberts, who was arrested by immigration authorities last week. Roberts is originally from Guyana, and immigration officials said he was in the U.S. illegally with no work authorization and no PhD. The district is suing the consulting firm based on breach of contract and negligence. Taylor Swift's new album, The Life of a Showgirl, marks her return to full-fledged pop music, but as NPR's Rachel Treisman reports, it's not all upbeat.
Swift reunited with Swedish producers Max Martin and Shellback, whom she worked with on Red, 1989, and Reputation. They made her 12th studio album during the European leg of her Eras tour, early in her relationship with her now fiancé Travis Kelce. Showgirl has plenty of pop melodies and love-struck lyrics, especially about Kelce. In Wishlist, Swift sings about her desire for marriage and motherhood. But the album also warns about the dark side of fame. One song tells the story of betrayal by a music executive. Another bites back at a fellow artist. The title track itself makes clear, the life of a showgirl isn't always glamorous. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
For the first time ever, the spiritual leader of the Church of England will be a woman. Sarah Mullally, the Bishop of London, will shatter a stained glass ceiling as the next Archbishop of Canterbury. St. Augustine was the first Archbishop of Canterbury in the year 597. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. Looking at weather tonight, partly cloudy with temps in the mid to upper 60s, breezy southeast winds up to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow mostly sunny with highs in the mid to upper 80s.
News. This is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. It is Friday. The federal government is still shut down, and outwardly at least, there appears to be no real progress toward any sort of deal. In fact, President Trump is bragging on social media that the impasse gives him more power to slash the federal government over Democrats' objections. What does it all mean, and what happens next? We will talk about that with NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez and senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi to you both.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, good to be here.
Frank, I want to start with you and this threat of layoffs. The White House has been threatening to permanently fire, not just furlough, a lot of federal workers. Usually people are put on furlough or called to work without pay. Why are we suddenly hearing about layoffs?
I mean, I think the big picture is this is something that Republicans and especially the MAGA wing of Republicans have been working on for years. I mean, a lot of it comes down to Russ Vogt. He's the director of the Office of Management and Budget. And some of our listeners will remember him as one of the key architects of the controversial Project 2025. You know, he has long advocated for a much more muscular OMB, a much more muscular White House that really acts more in an activist way of cutting spending and overhauling the federal government. And now that he's in office, you know, he's really taking that to heart, and he's got his fingers on some of the most controversial aspects or moves that this administration has taken in the first few months, including dramatically downsizing the federal bureaucracy, ending diversity hiring, and withholding billions and billions of dollars in congressionally appropriated funds.
It's really notable because during the campaign in 2024, then-candidate Trump was trying to distance himself from Project 2025, which was this blueprint created for a second Trump term by the Conservative Heritage Foundation, and Vogt was one of the chief authors. And all we've seen now is that a lot of the people who helped write Project 2025 and were part of it have just rolled right into the Trump administration.
Let's talk about the blaming and the messaging, because that's always a big part of the shutdown. And usually one side is blamed more than the other. And that kind of is a pretty clear indicator of how the shutdown is going to end, who's going to get what they want. Democrats saying they're refusing to back a funding bill without extending Affordable Care Act subsidies, and Republicans continue to escalate their rhetoric. Domenico, what sticks out to you about how the White House is talking about all of this?
Well, look, the president has a bully pulpit. He's not afraid to use it. Democrats really can't seem to figure out what to hit him with. I mean, healthcare is a pretty smart place for Democrats to start from because the Affordable Care Act now has a 64% favorability rating when it comes to the KFF tracking poll. That's pretty high. Certainly not where it was in 2010 when Democrats lost a bunch of seats. And look, it's absolutely true that if you don't extend subsidies, then it's going to get way more expensive to buy healthcare for millions of people. Republicans feel like they're able to say, this is not what is in anything that Republicans have put in the bill, and that Democrats are just trying to extract a negotiation around something that is unrelated.
Franco, let's talk specifically about the White House language here. The White House has the biggest pulpit for sure.
Here's this morning White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt speaking to Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition.
They picked a partisan fight over health care funding, which, by the way, is a fight and a discussion worth having, but we can't have it at the ninth hour when the federal government is shutting down.
So, Franco, that's on one hand. On the other hand, you have President Trump tweeting racist memes, AI-generated videos, mocking Democrats and really celebrating opportunities to punish Democrats and Democrat-controlled states. How does that leave space to have a serious conversation like what the press secretary is talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's real questions about how much the president is taking this seriously. I mean, look, this stuff is going viral on TikTok. It's going viral on Instagram. It is all over the place. And I'll just note, you're not seeing Democrats as much on those platforms. So good or bad, whether it's a show of seriousness, I think that's a debatable question. But what I think you can't debate is that he is controlling the narrative in at least this fashion.
Unity is really important in a shutdown, and right now Republicans, the Republican base, certainly has more unity than Democrats. Our poll this week, the NPR PBS News poll with Marist College, found that 77% of Republicans back Republicans in Congress. Only 48% of Democrats back Democrats in Congress. So there's the potential here that Democrats could fracture a bit, that they're not certain of what the strategy should be. The person who seems to be leading that strategy, one of them anyway, is Chuck Schumer, who's the Democratic leader in the Senate. And here he was talking about that strategy and what they're going to do on MSNBC's Morning Joe this week.
We're willing to sit down and negotiate a good deal to help the American people out of the health care dilemma. But in the meantime, we are going to be fighting everywhere, on TV stations like yours, in the social media, in picketing, in protesting, in emails, in every way.
The fact is, Schumer is not exactly the best messenger oftentimes for Democrats. He's not someone, as Franco is talking about, going viral on social media for the right reasons and pushing back against Trump. So Democrats are really searching and have been searching since Obama was out of the White House in 2016 for who their messenger can be. And the message war is going to be what winds up ending this shutdown.
So any sense what the path forward is at this point in time?
Well, Democrats start out with a marginal advantage here. Our poll found that by a 38-27% margin that people would blame Republicans more than Democrats. But 31% of people are undecided. So the messaging that takes place is going to be key, because that 31% is who they're targeting both sides to try to win over. And we know that in 2019, when the longest shutdown in history took place, Trump was being blamed far more than he's being blamed right now. And that's what sort of pushed him to the table. But that took a month.
You know, I think really a big question is, how long does this go? Because if it keeps going longer and longer, and vote gets the opportunity to make a lot of these cuts, and those cuts start to have impact, whether it's firing of federal workers, cuts to health care, I think real people are going to start feeling the effects, and I think you might see a difference.
Franco Ordonez, Domenico Montanaro, thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, Taylor Swift is used to attention. For the better part of 2 years, millions of people saw her perform during her record-breaking world tour. And just in August, she announced that she was engaged to football star Travis Kelce, which produced even more fanfare. But does Taylor actually still want the spotlight?
You're sweeter than a peach, but you don't know the life of a showgirl, babe. And you're never ever gonna.
Her new album, which just dropped today, is called The Life of a Showgirl. In it, she dives deep into her life offstage and contemplates whether or not she's ready to walk away from the pop star life. Here with us today to break it all down for us is NPR Music's Stephen Thompson. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Elsa.
Hello, hello. Okay, so Travis said this album was a banger on he and his brother's podcast. Is this album a banger to you?
Well, I mean, it's certainly been billed as such, and it's definitely a pivot away from this kind of dusky, autumnal, folky sound that she's been exploring on recent records. She's also, you know, she's kind of switched producers back to the producers she was working with on albums like Red in 1989, Max Martin and Shellback, and they give it not so much a sense of like wall-to-wall colossal pop bangers, but just a little bit more range. It can be theatrical or soulful or spangly, like in the song Opalite.
Whole
world knows Taylor and Travis are betrothed. What do you think this album reveals to us about their relationship? I mean, like, beyond what we keep seeing in the Instagram posts or the tabloids.
Well, several songs early on are clearly about falling in love with Travis Kelce. Lots of stuff about, like, I'd be melancholy if you hadn't found me, you know, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. There is a song that's pretty clearly about him that I really like called Honey that talks about the language couples use and how the meaning of words can shift depending on whether those words are used in good faith or bad faith. The one that feels the most enlightening, that is probably saying the most about her thoughts on the relationship, would be the song Wishlist, where she imagines a life of normalcy that has obviously eluded her.
I mean, and that is such a sweet side to this record. But also, come on, we all know that Taylor loves using music to take on critics, whether they be exes or other artists, right? So do you hear her doing that on this record?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Give it to us.
I mean, it's Taylor Swift. I mean, she is settling some scores here. I want to tread somewhat carefully because a lot is left for listeners to assume. And some of those songs are definitely dropping Easter eggs that are allowing sleuths on the internet to kind of piece together what they're about.
Which she loves to do. She loves dropping those eggs.
Yeah, she does. I mean, you've got a song like Canceled, which is kind of a dig at people who've criticized her friends. The song Father Figure is, you know, dressing down a music industry executive. Fans can surely tell you which one. And there's a song called Actually Romantic that appears to be a response to the Charlie XCX song Sympathy is a Knife. Like a toy chihuahua barking at me from a tiny purse. That's how much it hurts. Actually Romantic is saying, like, you know, the fact that you're obsessed enough to write and talk smack about me is actually romantic. But writing a song, mocking someone for writing a song is definitely a move. We'll leave it at that.
Okay, so a lot of this album feels like it is about Taylor's struggle with the spotlight, but it's also about her newfound love. But do we also get a sense of what she wants to do next?
Well, I would imagine a lot of the scuttlebutt about what she wants to do next is going to revolve around getting married. But what's interesting to me about her next step is that Taylor Swift is very, very famously into numbers. This is her 12th album. Her next album is her 13th. And I don't need to tell any Taylor Swift fans listening how big the number 13 is to Taylor Swift.
That is NPR Music's Stephen Thompson. Thank you so much, Stephen.
Thank you, Elsa.
And you can hear more of his thoughts on the new Taylor Swift album on the new Music Friday podcast from NPR Music.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:18, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. Coming up next is your daily dose of phonology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from this date. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health, with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Now it's time for your daily dose of phonology with John Latimer.
On today's date, October 3rd, 1985, common blackberries began to show some color. The blackberries are a magnificent plant to study in the fall because they carry some of the most beautiful colors that you can imagine. They go from green to orange to red to a very deep, deep burgundy, and they keep those leaves on for quite a while, long after all the other leaves are off. You will still continue to see the beautiful leaves of the common blackberry. I would highly recommend that if you have blackberries, if you've been picking blackberries this summer and you have blackberries that you know the location of, you should probably take the time here in October to get out and give them a good looking over.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Anemone, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. Two brothers wrestle with their past and the one secret that has kept them apart for decades. Anemone, rated R, in theaters today. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. All too often, we share news of horrible violence on this show. And this next story is not that. It does start with that, though, so just stay with me. Last Sunday, of course, hundreds of worshipers with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints were gathered for a service in Michigan when a man rammed his truck through the chapel doors, began firing, and set the building ablaze. Four people died before he was killed in a shootout with the police. In the aftermath, as they often do, people set up online fundraisers for the victims' families. David Butler found himself thinking, they're not the only victims. Butler lives in Utah and is a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints himself, and he created a fundraiser for the family of the shooter. It's gone on to raise over $300,000 at the time of this taping. Dave Butler joins me now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Hey, thanks very much for having me, Scott.
Why'd you decide to do this?
I saw somebody else's tweet suggesting it was a good idea, and that seemed obviously correct to me, and nobody else had done it, so I stepped up.
You say obviously correct, but I don't know if everybody would think that.
Well, I think maybe there's a blind spot here. Thomas Sanford committed a horrible crime, during the course of which he was killed.
Yeah.
He left behind a widow and a 10-year-old son. The boy has congenital hyperinsulinism and is obviously innocent. So I want to push back a little on your suggestion that it's not obvious and provide an alternative interpretation.
Yeah.
I think that I happen to be the guy that set up this Give, Send, Go, but I think that if I hadn't done it, somebody else would have done it.
You had a post on that page that jumped out to me. I've been standing in a hurricane of love and generosity for 3 days now. Can you tell me more about that thinking?
Yeah. Sorry. It's a little emotional.
Mm-hmm.
I told my wife Tuesday morning, I said, hey, listen, I think we'll raise a few $1,000 and that'll be it. And we raised $100,000 by the 12-hour mark. And if you go and look at the Give, Send, Go, there are some 8,500, in fact, 8,501 as of right now, contributions. The average is $40.
Mm-hmm.
And while they're doing this, they're posting messages of love and hope and acceptance. It's been incredible.
You know, it's interesting. Money is a limited thing. It's a zero-sum thing. But empathy is not. And yet I think a lot of times we think about it as a limited thing, that it's hard to have empathy for people on all sides of a situation when, like you're saying, that's not the case. It is very possible.
It is very possible. I also think that just a moment's thought, man, the 10-year-old son is not on the other side. He did not fill up a gas can for his dad and say, go get the Mormons, right? Mm-hmm. That did not happen. That guy, he's not an aggressor. Nobody needs to forgive him. We need to love him. We need to help that kid.
You know, you're touching on something as we were thinking about the story together. We kind of had an editorial conversation. Is this a conversation about forgiveness? Is this a conversation about empathy? Is this a conversation about love? It seems like you've thought about that as well. Because like you said, this isn't about the shooter specifically.
It isn't. I think people, if you read down the messages, I think that some people are experiencing having a forgiveness event, and especially sort of if you think about this maybe from an LDS perspective. I'm going to forgive him, we are going to forgive him, and the concrete thing we're going to do to show our forgiveness is we're going to love his family, right? And maybe that's the way to think about the sort of the Mormon story here. There is another story, which is not everybody who has contributed is LDS. And I know that there are mainline Christians, and I know that there are Jews, and I know that there are atheists who are contributing to support the family, right? And they may each have different reasons. It may not be forgiveness. It may be something more like empathy, compassion, love, help. And I think the sort of the overall story that unites both those stories is, hey, look, there are divisions among us, but I think this is a moment where many thousands of people are finding they can come together to help somebody in need and just completely set aside those divisions.
Well, Dave Butler, thanks for doing this, and thanks for talking to us about it.
Scott, thanks for having me on.
Earlier this week, the tech firm OpenAI launched a new social media app where all the videos are generated using artificial intelligence, like this body cam footage of a cop pulling over a dog.
Evening, you know why I pulled you over? Wait, is that a dog? All right, pause off the wheel, buddy. Stop the car! Dispatch, driver just fled. It's a dog, repeat, canine driver headed west.
NPR's Jeff Brumfield has more on what it means when literally everything on a social media app is fake.
Have you ever imagined what the cartoon character SpongeBob SquarePants might be like if he were a fascist dictator? No? Well, someone did, and now.
Citizens of Bikini Bottom! For too long, the meddling fish have nibbled away at our prosperity. They clog our streets, steal our work, and pollute our jellyfish fields, but no more.
SpongeBob in a khaki uniform with a red anchor behind him was literally the first thing I saw when I opened Sora, the new social media app from OpenAI, and it kind of sets the tone for the whole thing. Basically, the app looks like TikTok, except users can generate a very realistic 10-second video of whatever they want simply by punching a description into a small text box at the bottom of the screen.
Clearly the memes are going to be good, right? this is quite a product.
Solomon Messing is at New York University's Center for Social Media and Politics. He was frankly blown away by the videos I showed him, including this one I made of Richard Nixon.
My fellow Americans, tonight I have learned that the moon landings were faked. NASA has misled us all, and the trust of this nation has been shaken.
Okay, so that's very convincing.
And the fact that in literally 2 minutes I could create a real sounding and looking video about a fake conspiracy theory, that has Messing very worried.
We may be entering an era when the stuff that we see just isn't believable at all. Like, seeing is no longer believing.
Sora is just the latest in a slew of tools that can generate images, audio, video.
We're really seeing the ability to kind of whole cloth generate incredibly realistic, hyper-realistic content in any different way you want.
Henry Idar runs Latent Space Advisory, which tracks the evolution of AI-generated content. He says fake videos keep getting easier and easier to make, and he worries it's eroding people's trust in reality.
We have to resist the kind of somewhat nihilistic pull of we can't tell what's real anymore and therefore it doesn't really matter anymore.
Videos from Sora do have visible watermarks and they contain metadata that identifies them as AI generated, but Idar worries it won't be enough. Without a broader set of rules or regulations for identifying AI content, he thinks people may just start believing whatever they want. It's all pretty anxiety producing, so to feel better, I had Sora make a video of me sipping a martini.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff Brumfield, on a yacht.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Wi-Fi to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. The 9th Annual Monarch Butterfly Festival is tomorrow from 1 to 4 at the new Bemidji Veterans Home on Ann Street. There will be speakers, music, and a children's butterfly parade. Kids should arrive before 3 o'clock to create butterfly wings for the parade. And we receive support from Headwaters Music and Arts in downtown Bemidji, offering music lessons and art programming for all ages. More at headwatersmusicandarts.org or on Facebook and Instagram. Now it's time for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A tribe on Alaska's North Slope recently hosted an emergency management course in Utqiagvik. Organizers say it's the first for a tribe in Alaska and part of an effort to bolster coordination between communities in the Arctic during disasters. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Naiden reports.
Inupiat community of the Arctic Slope is the original tribe representing seven North Slope villages. The tribe worked with the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, to host a course to prepare villages to respond to disasters. Stephanie Nelson is the Director of Emergency Management for the tribe. She says the training was important in light of increasing emergencies in the region and given the isolated geography of many North Slope communities.
And the outcome is enhancing the communication from all attendees and becoming better at being prepared to respond to different levels of incidences, emergencies that we face within the Arctic.
Nelson says that two major discussions focused on scenarios similar to actual emergencies from 2022, like Typhoon Mirbok in Point Hope and a gas leak at Alpine Oil Field near New Exit. Participants used those examples to discuss how cities, North Slope Borough, and tribal governments can work together in an emergency situation. The course is a result of the tribe's efforts to implement an official emergency management program. John Pennington is a professor of Homeland Security and Emergency Management at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
It's using the strength of the Alaska Native communities that are the North Slope to improve emergency management through the lens of Alaska Natives first and foremost.
Pennington says that communities in the Arctic have been seeing intensifying storms and erosion. The state of Alaska is responsible for a vast area where several communities can experience disasters at the same time. But Pennington says that the tribe's new emergency program will also help North Slope communities to seek disaster declarations directly from the federal government when needed, which can speed up the delivery of assistance. In Anchorage, I am Alona Knighton.
The Indian Health Service is operating as business as usual during the federal government shutdown, which started Wednesday. The IHS says it has received advanced appropriations. Tribal leaders from across the country have been raising concerns about the shutdown. This week, President Thora Walsh Padilla of the Mescalero Apache tribe in New Mexico updated her community in a social media post, saying health services are operating normally, but says she's concerned about other federal programs, including Medicaid, food stamps, and Social Security, but assures the community the tribe continues its work.
Tribal leadership has conveyed our concerns to our federal representatives, and we are continually reaching out for updates as the federal budget is being developed. But please be assured, we will get through this together. Our tribe will still stand strong.
The National Congress of American Indians is also raising concerns about the government shutdown and has posted a resources page online for tribes. Governor Stephen Ro Lewis of the Gila River Indian Community in Arizona sending his condolences on behalf of the tribe to the family, colleagues, and friends of Dr. Jane Goodall. The well-known primatologist passed away this week at age 91. She spent time on the Gila River Indian Reservation on Earth Day. Lewis says she reached out to young people.
To encourage them to be leaders, to be protectors of our water, of our land, of our wildlife, and of our planet.
Lewis says the tribe looks forward to carrying on her legacy of conservation. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by Drummond Woodsum, a full-service law firm whose nationally recognized tribal nations practice provides services to tribal nations and their enterprises and to companies that do business with tribes across the country. More at dwmlaw.com. Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nye.
Native Voice 1.
the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation, streaming at BritBox.com. From Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where white sand beaches meet the arts, from the Dalí Museum to more than 500 public murals. More at visitspc.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Almost 2 years into the war in Gaza, Hamas says it has agreed to release all the Israeli hostages, dead and alive, still being held in Gaza. President Trump wrote in response to this announcement online that Israel must now immediately stop bombing Gaza. Here to explain is NPR's Aya Betraoui, who joins us now from Dubai. Hi, Aya.
Hello, Elsa.
Okay, so Trump says that he believes that Hamas is ready for a lasting peace based on its response here. Can you just tell us more about what exactly Hamas is agreeing to?
Yeah, so this is all coming in like the last hour or so. Basically, Hamas said they agreed to release all the Israeli hostages. That means 20 who are alive and about 28 who are dead. And according to Trump's plan, that would have to happen in the first 72 hours of a ceasefire. But what Hamas said is that actually it's based on field conditions. And so what does that mean? Basically, a Hamas leader went on Al Jazeera soon after and said it could be months before the bodies of the hostages are found. It's believed to be some of them could be buried under tunnels that are destroyed or in areas that would need heavy machinery that's not available in Gaza to reach. So essentially, he's saying talks under fire won't work here. Now, here's what that means as well. Hamas is saying there are still points of this deal that Trump laid out, 20-point plan for ending the war in Gaza, that need negotiation. And so what that does is that leaves the door open for both agreeing to the deal, which they have, but also having a seat at the table and negotiating the finer points that still do need clarification.
But does this mean, Aya, that we are heading into a ceasefire and maybe even the eventual end of this 2-year war?
Yeah, and let's remember here, the war in Gaza, Israeli fire has killed more than 66,000 Palestinians, 20,000 of them children, according to Gaza's health ministry, and there's currently an ongoing offensive on Gaza City. So what this plan essentially aims to do, and that all the stakeholders agree on, including the Arab states that are a part of this, is that the war must end. This is a plan not to temporarily pause the war, but to end it. It also releases many Palestinian detainees, Elsa, hundreds of bodies that Israel holds of Palestinians, and crucially, it would lift Israeli restrictions to allow much more food into Gaza through a UN-led system to reverse starvation there. But the deal is far from done. Look, this week we did hear the negotiators, the Arab mediators, Qatar and Egypt, senior officials from both countries come out and say there are parts of this plan that are far from clear. Mm-hmm. Example would be troop withdrawal. When would Israel withdraw its troops? The disarmament of Hamas. Would Hamas be storing its weapons, giving up its weapons? How and when would that happen? How about the deployment of Arab forces into Gaza? Egypt says it's ready to do that, to help with that, but they need a clear mandate for those forces and they need a UN Security Council resolution. There's also a board that would be governing Gaza that would essentially be chaired by President Trump himself. But what role would Palestinians have in actually implementing their own governance in Gaza? So all of these are questions that are still going to have to be negotiated, and Hamas wants to be at the table for that.
So much still unresolved. Okay, what has the response been from Israel so far?
Well, we did hear Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu agree to this plan and praise it alongside President Trump at the White House on Monday when it was unveiled. But there is deep mistrust on all sides, including between Israel and Arab states, the mediators, not just with Hamas. So his public acceptance of the plan does not necessarily mean that they all agree on the finer points of it. We also heard from members of his far-right coalition, like his finance minister in Israel, after the peace plan was announced, calling it a tragedy of leadership. He said Netanyahu's initial unwillingness to conquer Gaza and adopt Trump's plan of basically everyone being displaced out of Gaza and Israel essentially turning it into some Riviera leaves no room for maximum achievement. So basically, Elsa, there's still a lot of actors here on all sides that can derail and undermine the plan before it's fully agreed on and implemented. But right now, what we do have is Trump saying to Israel to stop bombing Gaza, and we have Hamas saying they are ready to release all the hostages.
That is NPR's Aya Betraoui in Dubai. Thank you so much, Aya.
Thanks, Elsa.
are companies out there that churn out huge amounts of made-to-order DNA. Lab scientists buy it to help them develop things like new drugs or medical treatments. But some bits of DNA could be dangerous because they encode toxins or other biological threats. So companies have long taken measures to keep this bad stuff out of the wrong hands. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on how AI is making that job harder.
Lots of labs today are taking advantage of AI to design new biomolecules.
We're already seeing advances in medicine and public health.
Eric Horvitz is the chief scientific officer of Microsoft. He says the trouble is, often when you've got a powerful technology,
these same tools can also be misused.
He and some colleagues recently tested whether AI tools could take DNA codes for toxic or risky proteins and come up with new versions,
rewriting them in ways that could preserve their structure and potentially their function.
It turns out for AI, this was a cinch. It let them generate DNA designs for tens of thousands of variants. And these dupes were able to evade some standard security measures.
To our concern, these reformulated sequences slipped past the biosecurity screening systems used worldwide by DNA synthesis companies to flag dangerous orders.
So the team took action. They developed fixes for the screening software and rolled them out with the help of a DNA manufacturing industry group. And while they published their work in the journal Science, they didn't publish everything. In an unusual move, they say requests for full access to the data and software will have to go through a nonprofit biosecurity group. It will decide who has a legit need to know. Arturo Casadevall is a biologist at Johns Hopkins University who wasn't part of the research team. He thinks this is a reasonable way to manage this kind of sensitive information, because in the world of science,
if you're going to publish something, you got to be able to make the information available so others can check it.
He points out that all of this was a computer exercise. None of these AI-designed molecules were actually created in the lab. He understands why this could be legally tricky, but says without testing the molecules,
we don't really know the extent to which these things work.
So it's unclear how bad they might be. Still, this episode shows how AI is just adding more fuel to an old fire. Scientists have long argued over how to best keep the genetic tools and information that's needed for medicine and basic science from being misused to create new threats, like more deadly viruses or other bioweapons.
How do we get ahead of a freight train that is just ever more accelerating and racing down the tracks?
David Relman is a Stanford University microbiologist. He says this latest effort to identify an AI threat and fix it should be applauded, but
they addressed a problem that is changing so quickly that you couldn't hope to think that today's solutions are tomorrow's solutions.
He says it's like an endless game of whack-a-mole. James Diggins is with Twist Bioscience, a major DNA synthesis firm. He says they've been screening customers' DNA orders for about a decade.
And the number of times we've had to kind of refer an issue to law enforcement, I have more fingers on one hand. So this is an incredibly rare thing.
He believes the number of people who want to get DNA to do harm could be close to zero, but it's important to watch out for them. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE, People Power Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. The 18th annual Great Pumpkin Festival is tomorrow from 1 to 4 at Memorial Park in Brainerd. Enjoy games, crafts, and food. The Bemidji Symphony Orchestra presents the premiere of Sky Tinted Water Saturday, October 4th at 7 p.m. at Bemidji High School Auditorium. The song celebrates the 50th anniversary of Voyageurs National Park. Camp Confidence near Brainerd hosts Community Day this Sunday from noon to 5 with activities like pumpkin painting, a scavenger hunt, and more. Now for North Star Stories.
This is North Star Stories, voices from where we live. Today in Minnesota.
A new text message scam is targeting your personal banking information. Then, a rock band from Minnesota is in the national spotlight. And Minnesota expands legal cannabis sales. I'm Chantel Sings. The Minnesota Department of Revenue is warning residents about scam text messages. The messages claim to be from the department and ask people to click a link to update banking information and claim a refund. Officials stress these texts are fraudulent and that the department systems and taxpayer data are not at risk. Anyone receiving the text should not click the link. Report the message as junk and delete it. If you enter personal information, contact your bank immediately. The Department of Revenue says it never asks for financial details by text. In today's main story, Minnesota's own rock band War Bonnet recently won Best Live Music Performance Video at the 2025 Native American Music Awards. Reporter Jamad Jama talks with the members of the band about their music and future goals.
I've always been around our tribal drums. I had an interest when I was really young, and I'd watch some of my elders sing at the drum, and I always wanted to do that. Decades later, we created War Bonnet.
That's Chaz Wagner, the founder of War Bonnet, a Native American rock band from northern Minnesota. They blend traditional rhythms with modern sounds and compose original and compelling music.
A war bonnet is like a Native headdress. I wanted a name, too, that spoke to the band, about who we are.
And this year, their talent got them a big win, Best Live Music Performance Video at the 2025 Native American Music Awards.
I was shocked. You know, I didn't think we have a chance because it's highly competitive.
It is dawn.
That's the song Bigfoot, sung by Leah Lem, which won them that award in July. Leah and Chaz also produced separate Ampers programs. The music video features the band performing the song together, with string lights illuminating their faces.
What we created that day in there was magic. The song was more about internal struggling, but in a mysterious kind of a way.
Storytelling is a huge aspect of War Bonnet's sound, particularly weaving indigenous languages and folktales into their music.
So our third album, it was called Akimanidug, and that's the album that the song Bigfoot was on. So that whole album was like a revitalization. It was a preservation of language. The titles were in Anishinaabe Mo'en, the native language.
Akimanidug translates to earth spirits. War Bonnet also uses their music as an opportunity to tell traditional legends in a new, unique way.
There are songs that are influenced by our legend stories. Zhingabits, for example, which is the hell diver or a grebe. We write the music that comes through us.
One, two, two. Hey.
My name's Tony Parson. I'm the keyboardist for War Bonnet. The band started around 2017. Chaz Wagner asked me. We got started and we've been getting more into it ever since.
Tony thinks about the way the music can reach people, particularly his community.
I hope that when people hear it, they'll feel pride and empowered, want it to connect with our indigenous communities, and of course, reach others who aren't aware of the culture.
And in the eyes of Chaz Wagner, War Bonnet's journey is just starting.
I want to get my music out there. I mean, I hope it goes nationally, and I hope it goes globally.
For North Star Stories, I'm Jamal Jama.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Minnesota Office of Cannabis Management says adult-use cannabis sales are expanding statewide. Since June, the state has issued 37 business licenses, including 23 to micro-businesses now stocking products through tribal partnerships. The Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe became the second of Minnesota's tribal nations to sign an agreement with Governor Tim Walz, allowing the tribe to open recreational marijuana dispensaries outside of tribal lands. In addition, 13 medical cannabis dispensaries, including locations in Minneapolis, Duluth, and Rochester, are now selling adult-use products.
North Star Stories is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ampers.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. Sean Combs was sentenced today by a federal judge to 50 months in prison. At the conclusion of his trial back in July, the hip-hop mogul was convicted on two counts of transportation to engage in prostitution, but he was acquitted of more serious sex trafficking and racketeering charges. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento has covered the trial and was in the courthouse in New York City today. She joins us now. Hi, Isabella.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so tell us more about what this sentencing entailed.
So the judge took into account arguments from the prosecution, which delivered a very short presentation that mostly focused on the victims of Combs' actions. There was also a longer presentation from the defense, and they argued that in the 13 months that Combs has been behind bars, he has changed significantly. They said that he has gotten sober, become a mentor to many of the inmates around him, and that he needs ongoing treatment for his mental health and substance abuse challenges. The prosecution asked Judge Arun Subramanian for as many as 11 years in prison. The defense argued that the time he's already served is sufficient for the crimes that he was convicted of. The judge said that neither request was reasonable, and he sentenced Combs to be incarcerated for a little over 4 years.
Okay, and did the judge explain why he gave Combs more than the minimum that the defense was asking for?
So the judge told the court that he had to consider the very serious physical and emotional harm that Combs inflicted on two of his ex-girlfriends, Cassie Ventura and a woman who testified using the pseudonym Jane. There was a lot of graphic evidence and testimony from both of them, and the judge said he weighed it very seriously. The women were not present in the courtroom today, but the judge thanked them profusely for being brave enough to speak up. He told Combs that the violence he inflicted on them cannot be simply washed away, and he said a substantial sentence was necessary to send a message to abusers everywhere that there must be real accountability for their actions.
Mm. And I understand that Combs personally addressed the judge, which was quite a dramatic moment, I imagine, in the courtroom. What was that like?
That's correct, because as you may remember, Combs had declined to testify during the trial, so this was actually his first time speaking up and addressing the court. He spoke for around 10 minutes. He apologized by name to Ventura and Jane for the harm that he caused them. He turned to face his family, and his voice broke as he apologized to them for letting them down. He told the judge that the violence that he committed against these women is a burden he'll carry forever. And he said that he can't change the past, but he wants an opportunity to change his future. He asked for a second chance to give back to his community. And when the judge was delivering his sentence, he told Combs that there's light at the end of this tunnel and that after this sentence, there will be enough time for him to make something new of this next chapter.
Hmm. Who else spoke on behalf of Combs?
So six of his children approached the podium together, and they made very emotional pleas to the judge. His twin daughters discussed how hard it was for them to lose their mother at a young age, and they begged the judge not to take away their father as well. When Combs spoke later, he told his kids that he was really proud of them for speaking up, and he was, you know, looking back at them often, and he seemed very emotional taking it all in with them.
Well, Isabella, after the verdict in the trial back in July, I know that the defense team seemed to celebrate the fact that Combs was only convicted on these two prostitution-related charges. And I'm just curious, like, what was their reaction today?
Yeah, the energy was very different today. It was very serious. You know, there weren't any dramatic reactions from anyone, but I would say that the defense team, Combs, everyone was very stoic as they listened to the judge deliver his sentence. And, you know, it was a very serious day overall in the overflow room as well.
That is NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento. Thank you so much, Isabella.
Thank you.
In June, the Trump administration brokered what it called a historic peace deal between Congo and Rwanda, key parts of which were supposed to be implemented this month. President Trump has repeatedly claimed credit for resolving the decades-long conflict in eastern Congo. But on the ground, there is little sign that peace has taken hold, as Emmett Livingstone reports from the capital city of Kinshasa. And a warning, you will hear the sound of gunfire in this story.
On a dusty parade ground in eastern Congo, new recruits sing allegiance to their commanders. This is the latest show of strength by Rwandan-backed M23 rebels. In an ominous sign in the past few weeks, the rebels boasted of having enlisted over 7,000 new fighters. In videos posted by the rebels on social media, the M23's shadowy military leader, Sultani Makenga, addresses the recruits. His message, clear. M23 is not going anywhere. Back in February, M23 rebels and troops from neighboring Rwanda had seized eastern Congo's two largest cities and were threatening to march on the capital, Kinshasa. there were fears that Congo would collapse, which prompted the Trump administration to intervene.
So we're here today to celebrate a glorious triumph, and that's what it is, for the cause of peace.
It was a hopeful moment.
And this is a long time waiting.
On June 27th, the foreign ministers of Congo and Rwanda stood beside Trump at the Resolute desk in the Oval Office, smiling, shaking hands. Just months earlier, this image would have seemed impossible. M23 rebels have been fighting in this lush, mineral-rich corner of eastern Congo since late 2021. They're the latest in a line of ethnic Tutsi militias backed by Rwanda since the 1990s, when the genocide there spilled over the border into wide parts of eastern Congo. Under the US-brokered peace deal, Rwanda is supposed to pull out its forces, while Congo must disarm a militia Rwanda views as a threat. The hope is that foreign investment will follow, drawn by gold and some of the world's largest deposits of coltan, a key mineral for electronics. But so far, despite President Trump's claims, the deal hasn't delivered.
My name is Clémentine de Montjoie. I'm a senior researcher in the Africa Division at Human Rights Watch.
In July, M23 fighters backed by Rwandan troops killed at least 141 civilians. The real number is likely higher.
The M23 rounded off an area where farmers were often living in their field during the ploughing season and executed men, women and children as young as 9 months old.
Those reports are backed by the United Nations. This week, Bintou Keita, head of the UN peacekeeping mission in Congo, told the Security Council 1,000 civilians had been killed there since June.
There are discrepancies between the progress we see on paper and the reality we observe on the ground, which continues to be marred with violence.
Meanwhile, parallel peace talks between the Congolese government and M23, held in Qatar, have also stalled. That progress is critical to making the US-brokered deal stick, Trump's senior Africa advisor Massad Boulos told reporters over the weekend.
This is the last piece of the puzzle. As soon as we have a full agreement on that, the whole thing will go into execution mode.
And yet, M23's new recruitment push sends a different message. The US State Department says Rwandan troops are set to begin pulling out in October. But for now, that promise remains just that, a promise. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Kinshasa.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. October 5th through 11th has been declared National Banned Books Week by the American Library Association. There will be an open reading at Minnesota North College Itasca campus in Grand Rapids, Monday, October 6th at 7 p.m. in the McMahon Student Center. Community members are invited to read or listen to passages from their favorite books that have a history of being banned. The city of Nevis hosts an Oktoberfest celebration Saturday, October 4th from 3 to 8 p.m. with German food, music, games, and more. Visit nevischamber.com for more information. Weather tonight, partly cloudy with temps in the mid to upper 60s, breezy southeast winds up to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with highs in the mid to upper 80s, breezy south wind.
I feel like I